Sound. Michelle Josadovsky, welcome.
Good afternoon.
You wrote an article in July on the 9/11 Independent Commission, headed by former New Jersey Governor Thomas Keene, called Who's Who on the 9/11 Independent Commission. Your article says that the commission itself has produced a brief interim report where it hints to the lack of cooperation by the Department of Defense, Homeland Security, and other agencies in the government. And you then lay out three requirements of an independent commission: that the members are free of conflicts of interest, that is, free of encroachments from the executive and other branches of government, that commissioners and staff have no personal ties to senior Bush officials, which are being investigated, and that there are no links to the perpetrators or financiers of 9/11, including the bin Laden family. How does the independent 9/11 commission stack up, in your opinion?
Well, it doesn't. None of those conditions are met. The chairman of the 9/11 commission, former Jersey government Thomas Keene, is a business partner of Osama bin Laden's brother-in-law, at least according to CIA sources. He is a partner of Khalid bin Mahfouz, who is identified in the lawsuit by the families of the victims as the financier of 9/11. Okay, so there you have the guy who is investigating 9/11 and Osama bin Laden is a business partner of a Saudi financier who happens to be the brother-in-law of Osama bin Laden. So there's a conflict of interest. But in fact, the conflict of interest goes all the way down. I mean, you have people who are either linked up to Saudi Arabia financiers, or they're directly appointed by the White House. You have several members of the Council on Foreign Relations. So, in a sense, the people who compose this committee really are not. I don't think they're capable of actually looking into the issue of 9/11, and particularly the complicity of the U.S. government in 9/11, which I think is the complicity or camouflage by the U.S. government, namely the Bush administration.
Michelle, maybe we could go through some of the commission members. You have mentioned Thomas Keene already. What about Commission Counsel David Marcus?
Well, yes, Commission Counsel David Marcus has a very similar relationship to the financiers of 9/11, or the alleged financiers of 9/11, because he is his partner in a lawsuit, Wilmer Cutler and Pickering, which counts among its clients Prince Mohammed Al-Faisal, who is also identified in the lawsuit of the families of the victims as one of the three alleged financiers of the 9/11 attacks. And therefore, I think that's an obvious conflict of interest. But it's the constellation of these individuals, which I think is striking.
What about Henry Kissinger, who had resigned? He was the first chair of the commission, wasn't he?
Absolutely, he resigned because, in fact, he resigned for the same reasons. He had links to similar individuals. He had links to Saudi financiers, but he was. If you look at the people on that commission, you have several members of the Council on Foreign Relations. You have a former Secretary of the Navy, John F. Lehman, who actually is actually a staff member of Kissinger. A former staff member of Kissinger. He was recruited to the National Security Council way back when Kissinger was Secretary of State. And there you are. I mean, it's this kind of linkage. This is not an independent commission. This is this is a commission where the individuals are carefully handpicked, and then you realize they have links to Iran-Contragate, their former officials of the, let's say, of the Reagan administration in some cases, and in fact, the executive director Philip Zelikoff is virtually a staff member of the White House. Okay, so he is the guy who actually runs this independent commission, and at the same time he sits on the president's intelligence team, and then you have another person who is Jamie Gorelick. She is a very close partner of CIA Director George Tenet and serves on the CIA's National Security Advisory Panel, as well as on the President's Review of Intelligence Committee. So all these people, in effect, they're linked up to the CIA, the National Security Council, Henry Kissinger, the Council on Foreign Relations, and their function is not to reveal the truth on 9/11. Their function is essentially cover up and damage control, make sure that this remains within the realm of intelligence failures, lapses in the intelligence apparatus, lack of communication between the FBI and the CIA, and meanwhile the senior officials in the Bush administration who have dubious links to Al Qaeda or Pakistan inter-services intelligence. These people, of course, are not subject to any kind of investigation.
You know, according to your article, you say that Executive Director Philip Zelikoff even wrote a book with Condoleezza Rice.
Well, of course, yeah. He's a partner of Condoleezza Rice. Now, Condoleezza Rice, at least. Our research has shown that Condoleezza Rice is part of the cover-up. I mean, she's suppressing. She's involved in the suppression of information on the 9/11 attacks. I'm not saying that she's behind it, but I'm saying she is suppressing information, and she is an obstacle to revealing the truth on what is going on, because she's covering up for policy mistakes or whatever the underlying reasons. But particularly, she's covering up the fact that the Bush administration and previous administrations have supported and abetted the Al-Qaeda network right from its inception during the Soviet-Afghan War. And so, of course, if you appoint somebody who has a close relationship to Condoleezza Rice, you foreclose any kind of meaningful investigation which would tackle issues of political accountability in the 9/11 attack.
You mentioned Jamie Gorelick. In your article, you mention her as the CIA also has a seat on the commission.
Well, yes. She's a very close associate of the head of the CIA, and she, in fact, she's on the CIA's National Security Advisory Panel. She's on the President's Review of Intelligence. She's a member of the Council of Foreign Relations, which we know plays a behind-the-scenes role in the formulation of U.S. foreign policy. Her conflict of interest, visibly, is that she has a very close link to CIA Director George Tenet. So that, in effect, I'd say that this is the CIA appointee to the commission. Now, if we want to come up with any meaningful assessment of the role of George Tenet and the responsibility that he has in relation to the American public and the Congress and so on, we would have to have somebody who does not have a link, you know, a crony link to the head of the CIA. It's simple logic in a democratic system.
What about Lee Hamilton, the vice chair of the commission?
Well, Lee Hamilton, he's a Democratic appointee, because this is supposed to be a bipartisan initiative, and he was member of the House Select Committee on Intelligence previously. He was chairman of that select committee, when the Iran-Contra was being investigated, he was ultimately instrumental in the indictment of John Poindexter as well as Colonel Oliver North, as we recall, the main actors in the Iran-Contra scandal. John Poindexter, Colonel Oliver North, and Richard Secord. Note that John Poindexter now holds an official position in the Bush administration, even though he was accused of lying to Congress and so on, and it was a criminal indictment, later pardoned. But I think that Lee Hamilton is in fact he didn't really in his committee back in the 1980s, he didn't really investigate the roles of other senior Reagan officials involved in the Contragate affair, including Colin Powell and Richard Armitage. So I can't say that he's linked to the Bush administration, but he's the kind of person who's going to be involved in damage control procedures, which he implemented during the Contra investigation. The real architects of the Iran Contragate scandal were never indicted, and incidentally, for the record, it's very important that we remember that the person who actually authorized the transfer of weapons to Iran was Colin Powell, because Colin Powell signed the release forms at the level of procurement and logistics, so that these weapons — he was a senior member of the armed forces at the time, lieutenant general, and he was the senior military officer who signed the release forms so that the arms could be transferred to Iran via the CIA, and consequently he was really behind people like Oliver North. I mean, he actually was complicit in that process. So that again, Lee Hamilton, who was in charge of that investigation, just let those individuals through. And those same individuals, of course, are now active within the present administration. So I think what the Bush administration saw in Lee H. Hamilton is the fact that this person is a Democrat, but he's not going to lead this investigation in a direction which might harm the interests of the Bush administration. He will replicate the procedures that he applied during the Iran Contragate investigations and broadly implement damage control in this particular context.
Let's take a look at General Counsel Daniel Marcus. Who is he?
Well, as I mentioned earlier, Daniel Marcus is the legal counsel for the commission. Okay, he's a lawyer. Next to the executive director Philip Zelikow, he's sort of the number two. He's involved in day-to-day activities of the commission, as opposed to the chair and the vice chair. So he's a lawyer. He's a partner in Wilmer Cutlin Pickering, and as I mentioned, his company has as its clients Prince Mohammed El Faisal, who as I mentioned uh, who uh, is identified as one of the top three alleged financiers of 9/11 in the $1 trillion lawsuit. Now, again, it's a clear case of conflict of interest. On the one hand, Wilmer Cutlin Pickering has these prominent Saudis as their clients, which including, incidentally, the Bin Laden group. Okay, they're acting on behalf of these Saudi financiers, and now one of their partners, namely Commission Counsel David Marcus, is there to advise the 9/11 Commission on legal issues. So again, it's a clear case of conflict of interest. So I don't expect very much from this 9/11 independent commission, and nor do I expect very much from the joint inquiry headed by Bob Graham and Porter Goss for very similar reasons.
Michel, before we leave the 9/11 commission, what about Commissioner Richard Benvenisti? He's with the biggest bankruptcy firm, isn't he, that handled Enron?
Yeah, that's correct. The thing is that Benvenisti he's also a lawyer. He's a commissioner. He's partnered Mayor Brown, Rowan Moore. He's involved more or less. He has links to dubious links to Enron, and he specialized in representing in representing these energy consortia, so that in effect you might say that Benvenisti is really a Wall Street appointee. I mean, he represents the big players in the energy business, and again, his profile is similar to the other people on this commission. Their links to either their links to the CIA, or their links to the White House, or their links to to the National Security Council, and in this case, you have a guy who has links to Enron. So again, I would say I'd be very suspicious. These people do not represent the public. They're not people who can conduct an honest investigation into what happened on 9/11.
Would you say that as well about Fred Fielding? He's a commissioner.
Well, Fred Fielding, again, he was former White House counsel during the Reagan administration at the time of the Iran-Contra Gate scandal. He's also closely connected through personal ties to several members of the current Bush team, and he was also counsel during the Bush-Cheney presidential transition. Yes, it's consistent with other members that we discussed, although some are more, I think, some have more crucial links, like Max, David Marcus and Philip Zelikow are the sort of key individuals in that, and of course Thomas Kean, who is the chairman and who was on the board of directors of Amerada Hess, which is an oil company, and Amerada Hess was in a partnership joint venture with Delta Oil Company of Saudi Arabia, which is controlled by the Bin Mahfouz and Al Amoudi business clans, which are known to support Al Qaeda. So that's the background. It's a network of cronyism and conflict of interest, and it will only serve to support the political cover-up of the 9/11 attacks.
What do you respond to the criticism that the commission doesn't have enough money to do its job?
Well, yes, I wish we had 1%, 1/10 of 1% of the money that they have to conduct the investigations that we are conducting on 9/11. I think that the alternative media, our research center, the Center for Research on Globalization, which has zero budget, it comes from reader support. But we have produced more material, more critical material than this commission. The commission is not underfunded by any means. I think that's a red herring. People who say, oh, well, the commission is underfunded and they're going to help in revealing the truth and we must give them more money. I would take all the money away from them. Because in a sense, what they're doing is essentially misleading the public. And they're misleading the public at taxpayers' expense, which I think is even more serious.
The 9/11 Joint Congressional Inquiry has just recently released a 900-page report, 858 pages to be exact, with a very famous 28 pages missing that has to do with Saudi Arabia. Have you taken a look at this 900-page report?
Well, I've looked at the 900-page report. I haven't read the 900-page report, but I've skimmed through a lot of material. I think there's a lot of irrelevant material in there. What that report does is essentially it looks at the micro level. It says, well, this particular individual was in flight training, et cetera, et cetera. It points to individual terrorists, when they came into the United States, what they were doing, why the FBI did this, why the CIA did that, et cetera, et cetera. It doesn't address the more substantive issue, which is the history of Al-Qaeda, the fact that Al-Qaeda is a creation of the CIA going back to the Soviet-Afghan war, that every single administration since Jimmy Carter has supported Al-Qaeda, and that this is documented. It doesn't look at any of the political complicities underlying this relationship. The fact that Richard Armitage and Colin Powell were behind Al-Qaeda and have always been behind Al-Qaeda. The fact that Pakistan's ISI supports Al-Qaeda and that at the same time Pakistan's ISI is virtually a subsidiary of the CIA. All that, of course, is not mentioned. So what they're doing is they are churning out piles and piles of red herring in that 900-page report, and then they say, well, there are 28 pages of the report which are still classified and which we don't want you to read because it has to do with Saudi Arabia, and of course that's a ploy. That's a ploy. That's a media ploy, because immediately the only interest in that report are the 28 pages which are not published. The rest of it is unreadable. It's irrelevant. It's unreadable. But what they're really saying by not releasing these 28 pages is that they have triggered a media scam, a propaganda campaign, where everybody says, well, what's in these 28 pages? The Saudi Arabians are involved, et cetera, et cetera. And, of course, that diverts people's attention from the fact that it's not the Saudis who are involved, but, in fact, it's the Bush administration. And if the Saudis are involved, and indeed they have links to Al-Qaeda, they always act as proxies for agencies of the U.S. government, including the CIA. They have links, of course, to the Bush administration. They are buddy-buddy with the Bush administration. So in a sense, what is emerging in this debate on the role of Saudi Arabia is the fact that Saudi Arabia is responsible for 9/11, but we don't mention the links that these Saudi proxies have to the main political actors who are the members of the Bush cabinet and previous administrations. The fact that even the Bush family was involved with these Saudi financiers, going back to the BCCI scandal, that their financial links between the Bin Laden family and the Bush family, which are well documented. And so what my answer to all this is that if these Saudi Arabian financiers are involved and have supported al-Qaeda and have financed the training camps in Afghanistan and the madrasas, they have done it in the context of a CIA operation which was carefully planned right from the outset. These madrasas and CIA and training camps were set up with the support of the CIA, and then they used the Saudis to finance this operation. So again, I think that if one wants to really say, is there a Saudi connection? Yes, there is a Saudi connection, but that Saudi connection is one which implicates in a very direct way the architects of U.S. foreign policy and the CIA. And the fact that the 28 pages have not been released is simply they're creating more discussion on those 28 pages than what could have been achieved if they had been included in the report in the first place. So,
does it look to you like they're setting the Saudis up for attack?
I think that they want, if we look at the broader, the broader objectives of this Saudi connection, is that ultimately, I think the Bush administration and the U.S. and the people behind the Bush administration, including the Texas oil companies, what they want is a different, they want regime removal or regime change in Saudi Arabia. They want to have a more compliant monarchy. They don't want to share anything with the Saudi financial elites, which have a certain amount of clout. They have tremendous wealth. We have to understand that Saudi Arabia is the largest oil producer in the world, with one quarter of the world's reserves of oil and gas, 25%. That is about 10 times those of the United States. The United States has 2.2% of total oil and gas reserves, and Saudi Arabia has 25 or 26%. It's 25%. And then, of course, Iraq and Saudi Arabia, something like 36%. So evidently, it is very, there is a hidden agenda. The hidden agenda is to implement a much more direct rule, colonial rule in Saudi Arabia than the one which has been in existence up until now. In other words, instead of having a compliant monarchy, which shares in the oil wealth, we'll have some kind of compliant proxy Saudi prince who will more or less allow for the United States a more direct role in the colonial administration of Saudi Arabia as a territory. I think that's where we're going, and it's consistent with the type of arrangement which is being envisaged for other countries in the region, of course, including Iraq.
I notice in the media, both on radio, on television, in the newspaper, both pundits from the right and the left are obliging in this demonization of the Saudis. I hear it everywhere now.
Yeah, that's right. There's several objectives underlying that. One is of course a broad foreign policy objective of saying, well, let's use this Saudi connection to discredit the Saudi monarchy and the Saudi financiers, and the lawsuit is serving that purpose as well. Okay, The lawsuit is not directed against George W. Bush or Condoleezza Rice or Richard Armitage, who have played an behind the scenes role in this whole relation to 9/11. It's directed towards the Saudis. So it confuses people. It creates the illusion that somehow the Saudis are responsible, that there's some kind of outside enemy, that this outside enemy is funded by Saudi Arabia, and therefore it is legitimate to intervene in Saudi Arabia and demand some kind of regime removal. So there are two objectives. One is to mislead the public, and secondly, the second objective is to use this as a pretext for regime change in Saudi Arabia, which has a quarter of the world's oil reserves, 10 times those of the United States, which is, of course, something very important for the U.S. oil conglomerates in that region.
Michel, with regard to terrorism financing, on July 31st of this year, the Senate Committee on Governmental Affairs received testimony was presented by John Pistoli of the FBI Counterterrorism Division. You wrote an article about that called Terrorism Financing. FBI acknowledges 9/11 was financed out of Pakistan, which is interesting because in the 900-page joint inquiry report that you were talking about, was there any mention of Pakistan?
I've went right through those 900 pages with a search and replace or whatever on my keyboard, and there were a couple of references to Pakistan, but they didn't relate to any particular role that Pakistan might have had in the 9/11 attacks. There was no mention of Pakistan's inter-services intelligence. There was no mention of the fact that according to the FBI, it's a documented report which was made public in late September, that the head of Pakistan Inter-Services Intelligence, General Mahmoud Ahmad, allegedly transferred money to the alleged ringleader of the 9/11 attacks, Mohammed Atta. And one would expect at least that there'd be some mention of Pakistan's ISI, which is known to support al-Qaeda. It's known. I mean, I'm not inventing it. We can go to the Council on Foreign Relations homepage, and they will discuss it in length on the role of Pakistan's ISI, the fact that they supported the Taliban, that they supported al-Qaeda. Of course, they always supported al-Qaeda and the Taliban on behalf of their U.S. masters, because the ISI, the Pakistan's ISI, is essentially a subsidiary of the CIA. But what I think is revealing now is that with the statement of FBI's John Pistole, who's with the counterterrorism unit of the FBI, we have confirmation that Pakistan provided financial backing to the 9/11 terrorists. And what the statement of John Pistole points to is that he says high-ranking and well-known al-Qaeda operatives played a major role in moving the money forward eventually into the hands of the hijackers. Now, that statement, first of all, I think it opens up a can of worms. Because, first of all, it corroborates the statement made by the FBI in September 2001, where they acknowledge the role of Pakistan's inter-services intelligence, and the head of that agency, General Mahmoud Ahmad, in transferring money to the 9/11 terrorists, so that there's a consistency there. So that's the first aspect. And secondly, then it also discredits, of course, both the joint committee, the joint inquiry led by Bob Graham and Senator Bob Graham and Representative Porter Garth, both from Florida, who are the architects of this joint inquiry, they don't mention anywhere the role of Pakistan in their report. And thirdly, what it also does is it casts doubt on the 28 missing pages where they say there's a Saudi connection, but nobody talks about the Pakistani connection whether it's in the 900 page report of the joint inquiry or whether it's part of the 9/11 commission headed by Thomas Keane. And so there we are. If we start to digging, we'll see that in fact terrorist financing originates out of Pakistan. We know that already. We've produced tons of reports on that at globalresearch.ca. If we say that terrorism financing originates out of Pakistan, involving Pakistan's inter-services intelligence, the next question I have is, what were the two chairmen of the Joint Inquiry Commission, Senator Bob Graham and Representative Porter Goss, what were they doing on mission to Pakistan on the 28th of August 2001 when they met the head of Pakistan's inter-services intelligence, General Mahmoud Ahmad, who, according to the FBI, is the money man, the financier behind the 9/11 attacks. And these same individuals, Porter Goss and Bob Graham, were meeting up with the general on the morning of 9/11 at the U.S. Congress in a breakfast meeting. And that is well documented. And I'm not suggesting anything. I'm just saying that these guys also have a conflict of interest. They, on the one hand, they're entrusted in producing a 900-page report, but on the other hand, they have close links to an individual who, according to the FBI, and corroborated by John Pistole's statement, has close links to Al-Qaeda and the terrorists. And the Washington Post actually, in a beautiful, I mean, it's just incredible that this kind of statement would appear. Nobody would even would even ask any questions. But it just so happens that the individuals who were hosting this breakfast meeting, namely Bob Graham and Porter Goss, were meeting with the alleged financier of 9/11. And then the Washington Post acknowledges this, and they say Porter Goss and Bob Graham were having breakfast with the head of a spy agency which is known to support Al Qaeda and the Taliban, but they don't ask the more substantive question: what were members of the U.S. Congress and the Senate doing, having breakfast in the plush surroundings of the U.S. Congress on the morning of 9/11 with a man who is known to support the Taliban, in other words, the head of Pakistan's intelligence, who is known to support the Taliban and Osama bin Laden. And then these same individuals produce a 900-page report where they omit any reference to Pakistan, while pointing to Saudi Arabia's involvement in a 28-page section, which is missing for obvious reasons. So all this is part of a ploy to cover up the complicity of the Bush administration, its support of Pakistan's intelligence, the fact that the U.S. congressmen were also part of this ploy. I'd say that Bob Graham is far more linked up to Pakistan's ISI than anybody else in the Republican Party, since he had meetings on two occasions. One was on in late August in Islamabad, where he met the general Mahmoud Ahmad, head of Pakistan's ISI, the man, incidentally, who ordered the assassination of the leader of the Northern Alliance, General Shah Massoud, just 2 days before 9/11. Okay, and that is corroborated by official statements. The ISI was involved in the kamikaze assassination of Shah Massoud 2 days before 9/11, and the person who was behind that was the head of Pakistan's inter-services intelligence, according to statements of the Northern Alliance and also press reports. So there we are. I mean, so these people are part of the cover-up as well, and they're also covering up their own role in this complicit network of individuals.
And Bob Graham is running for the Democratic nomination for president as well.
Yeah, but Bob Graham is running for the nomination for the Democratic Party, and then he's hinting to the fact that the Bush administration is responsible for foreknowledge, et cetera. And he's hinting to things which are not being revealed, that they can't reveal, and so on and so forth. But what he doesn't say is the fact that he himself is very deeply implicated in the 9/11 nexus of dubious links to the general, to the Pakistan president, and so on. And Portagas even more so, because Portagas is a former CIA official who is a member of Congress for Florida. So there we are. I don't think, and just to link it up with the 9/11 Commission, we have two major inquiries, one under the auspices of the U.S. Congress and the Senate. It's a joint initiative of the Senate and the House, respectively coordinated by Senator Bob Graham and Representative Porter Goss. And then you have the other one, which is the so-called independent commission, which is nothing. It's not really independent because all the people on the commission represent the CIA, the White House, the National Security Council, the Council on Foreign Relations. They're not representative of the broader civil society. They're not, where you get people, honest people in the universities or with research institutes or whatever. You're not dealing with that. Both these commissions, the Joint Inquiry plus the 9/11 Commission, are part of the cover-up, and the individuals behind it have very suspicious links to the terrorist network, whether they have links to the Bin Laden family, or they have links to Pakistan's inter-services intelligence. And again, this is something very, very serious, and it's very important that the truth gets out. It's very important the truth gets out to the broader public. I've examined this in detail in my recent book, which is called War and Globalization, The Truth Behind September 11, which you can order either at our website at www.globalresearch.ca or by calling our 1-800 number. It's 1-888-713-8500.
The administration has launched two wars to date, supposedly in response to 9/11, the attack on Afghanistan, and now the invasion of Iraq. You and Ian Woods authored an article called The Road Map to Empire, in which you talk about the big lie and releasing the big lie. That is the justification for some of these wars. What is that?
Well, the thing is that prior to the onslaught of this war, there were two essentially pretexts for waging this war, which were part of the propaganda ploy. One was the weapons of mass destruction, and the other one was the links of the Iraqi regime of Saddam Hussein to Osama bin Laden. And that was pushed in the media ad nauseum, the weapons of mass destruction, the fact that this was a threat to America, the fact that Saddam was behind the 9/11 attacks, and so on and so forth. And all this whole ritual, which in fact was disproved by the United Nations Security Council discussions, the fact that the weapons of mass destruction, we knew it well in advance. We've documented this months ago that this was all a fabrication. But if you look at what the U.S. media did, is that they maintained the weapons of mass destruction fiction up until the formation of a post-war colonial government, the so-called authority, which was duly sanctioned by the United Nations. When the US-UK authority was put in place, the big lie was released. And then they said, oh, yes, the Bush administration was involved in cooking the books. I'm using the actual words of Time magazine. The Bush administration was accused of cooking the books and of misleading the public on the weapons of mass destruction and the fact that Bush had made statements in his State of the Union address where he said which later turned out to be incorrect. But bear in mind, some people believe that the media somehow has is involved in a turnaround, that they're ultimately seeing the truth, they're revealing the lies, they're attacking the Bush administration, etc., and they're upholding freedom of the press. I say no, that's not what happened. The media are part of this complicity, the corporate media are part of this complicity, because they deliberately withheld a debate in the tabloids, on the front pages of this big lie until early June, okay, when then the invasion plan had been completed, the Bush administration was in charge of Iraq, and so on and so forth. In other words, it was ex post. The Bush administration had achieved its objectives, and then you can say, of course, let's pull the plug on George W. It doesn't really make any difference now. He's performed his role. In any event, George W. is a political puppet on behalf of the U.S. oil companies, Wall Street, the military industrial complex, the big defense contractors, and so on. It doesn't really matter if he's discredited now. It upholds, in a sense, the idea that we're in a democracy and that leaders must be held accountable. And so that's the ritual. What I noticed is just incredible that the people who are behind the project for the New American Century, which is this blueprint of conquest, very explicit, okay? And in this blueprint of conquest, we have Wolfowitz, Richard Armitage, Dick Cheney, plus a number of other people, Richard Pearl. All these are the key architects behind this doctrine of preemptive war. But these people are prepared to pull the plug on George W. Bush because they want this to transcend an administration which is now in a very difficult situation, and I find it's very revealing that the person who actually pulled the plug on George W. Bush is the chairman of the PNAC, William Kristol, who was responsible for drafting the PNAC's blueprint entitled Rebuilding America's Defenses, Strategy, Forces, and Resources for a New Century, which essentially contains all the war. It contains the war agenda. It proposes simultaneous war theaters. And the fact that William Kristol, who's chairman of the PNAC, actually pulls the plug on George W. Bush I think is very revealing. He happens to be the editor of the New York Weekly Standard, which in fact has been part of the disinformation ploy right from the outset, and certainly in the weeks leading up. I mean, like every other U.S. Mainstream magazine or Time Magazine, Newsweek, whatever, plus the Daily Press, they're part of this. They were part of this war agenda. They didn't do anything to prevent the war from happening. But now that the war has achieved its objectives and the oil companies are there sharing the spoils, well, then it's okay. We can pull the plug on George W. and then say that points to the fact that we are still in a democracy and people must be held accountable and so on. And meanwhile, the main actors behind all this, who are the oil companies, the defense contractors, they simply sit back and cash in on the spoils of war.
Right. In your article, A Roadmap to Empire, you say that none of the current public outcries for accountability will reverse the tide of U.S. military expansion as outlined for the Project for a New American Century. The PNAC is a neoconservative think tank linked to the Defense Intelligence Establishment, the Republican Party, and the powerful Council on Foreign Relations, which plays a behind-the-scenes role in the formulation of U.S. foreign policy. The PNAC's declared objective is quite simple: to fight and decisively win in multiple simultaneous theater wars. In fact, barely after the so-called liberation of Iraq, the Bush administration announced that Iran would be next in line. You go on to say more recently the administration has initiated, with the support of the UN, a similar weapons of mass destruction inspection drill, including the spreading of false information directed at Iran.
Well, absolutely. The PNAC is a blueprint for global conquest, because when they say that the objective is to, quote, fight and decisively win in multiple simultaneous theater wars, okay? And they present this more or less as a means to preserving Pax Americana. It's part of U.S. foreign policy. Well, and they are, in fact, they also, when they say that Iran is next, well, that's contained in the PNAC. But incidentally, it was also contained in the national security strategy of the Clinton administration, formulated in the mid 90s. Where they said that that the first objective or the first target of in theater war, and it in fact emanates from Central Command, so it's an official document. The first objective is Iraq, and the second is Iran, and that was already formulated in the mid 90s by the Clinton administration. So it's a strategic objective to conquer the entire region, which encompasses, if you look at the map, the region which extends from the tip of Saudi Arabia up to the Caspian Sea basin. We're talking about 70% of the world's supplies of oil in that broader region. So that's where all the pieces come together: the conquest of Iraq, the eventual conquest of Iran, which has already been announced by the Bush administration, the destabilization of the Saudi monarchy and the regime change in Saudi Arabia, and then again also the reinforcement of U.S. protectorates in the former Soviet republics. The main target there would be Azerbaijan, which is one of the major oil and gas producers of the former Soviet Union, now very much in the zone of influence of the United States. So that's the broad agenda. It's essentially a war of conquest. And then if you look at the region extending, let's say, from the Mediterranean, right, let's say, to the Chinese border, where you have Afghanistan. Afghanistan's very important because it's a land bridge between these oil and gas reserves of the Caspian Sea basin and the Arabian Sea. It's a land bridge for pipeline routes. It's also at the hub of Central Asia, with the borders. It borders onto China, the former Soviet Union, and the war on Afghanistan was the opportunity for the United States to militarize China's western frontier, so that in effect those two wars, Afghanistan and Iraq, I suspect are part of a broader strategy of extending the U.S. empire from the Middle East into Central Asia, into the former Soviet Union, eventually encroaching on Russia and China.
You also talk about a green light to the use of nuclear weapons. You say barely a few weeks following the entry of the U.S. Marines into Baghdad, the Senate Armed Services Committee gave the green light to the Pentagon to develop a new tactical nuclear bomb to be used in conventional weapons theaters with a yield 6 times more powerful than the Hiroshima bomb. You say that according to Canada's Uranium Medical Research Center, tests conducted on Afghan civilians suggest that, quote, some form of uranium weapon had been used. The results were astounding. The donors presented concentrations of toxic and radioactive uranium isotopes between 100 and 400 times greater than in the Gulf War veterans tested in 1999. It sounds like they may have used nuclear weapons in Afghanistan and no one is aware of it, perhaps?
Well, yes, I think that that's what, when I read that report, incidentally, which is based on the Uranium Medical Research Center, the Canadian-based research center, which has conducted research on the impacts of radiation on civilians in Afghanistan, and those tests, exactly what you just mentioned. It does suggest that something else, other than depleted uranium, was used in the Afghan war theater. Namely, that they could have used one of those so-called mini nukes or tactical nuclear weapons. I think we have to address that issue, because repeatedly the Bush administration has said, yes, we will use them. Okay. Donald Rumsfeld has said, yes, we will use conventional weapons, but we don't exclude the use of nuclear weapons. And they repeated that. Incidentally, they even made that statement 1 week before George Bush's famous State of the Union address. It was a spokesman from the White House who said, yes, we will use mini nukes against Iraq if they use weapons of mass destruction against us. And the British even said that they will use conventional nuclear weapons from these are Trident nuclear warheads, which would be launched from submarines in the Persian Gulf. And they made that statement in the House of Commons again in the months leading up to the war. So I'm talking about the war in Iraq. So that these statements are consistent. But if we look at more recent developments, just a couple of weeks ago, there was a secret Pentagon meeting in Nebraska at the Strategic Command Center, Offutt Air Force Base in Nebraska, where they started to examine America's nuclear weapons options. They got the green light from the Senate, and they brought in a whole series of people, and they had a conference, and then they said, well, yes, we should use these nuclear weapons as part of the preemptive war against rogue states. And in a sense, it's a strange Lovian type of logic. First, they say that the mini nukes are small, harmless to civilians. They're small nuclear devices, but They're harmless because the explosions are underground. Of course, the radiations will kill civilians in the same way as the Hiroshima bomb. Then they say, well, they're harmless to civilians. And they also say we have to defend ourselves against these rogue states and the weapons of mass destruction that they possess. And they say we will use these small nuclear weapons in conventional war theaters. And so that conference in Nebraska, which was held, it was held right at the beginning. Wait a minute, it was held on the 7th of August. No, I mean a couple of weeks ago. It's very clear that they're trying to build public support on the use of these nuclear weapons, with a whole propaganda campaign saying that the nuclear weapons are harmless. And I suspect, if we take this report from the Uranium Medical Research Center seriously, I suspect that these mini-nukes could well have been used in the Afghani war theater. It's certainly consistent with the statements which the Bush administration has made regarding their potential use. And the fact that they now have the green light to use them. But if they were used in Afghanistan, I would suspect that they would also have used them in Iraq. So we are dealing with something far more devastating and far more serious than depleted uranium. Bear in mind that the mini-nukes, because the explosions of these mini-nukes is very similar to conventional weapons, the so-called bunker buster bombs, it is not always possible to establish from the various war reports whether these mini-nukes have been used or not. Okay, it doesn't create a big mushroom like in Hiroshima, since the explosion is underground, but nonetheless, it is a possibility that these mini nukes have been used, and there are indications from statements of the Bush administration, but also the fact that these tests, which are provisional, these tests of radiation in Afghanistan, indicate a scenario of extreme forms of radiation.
Do you think it's possible that the administration could be stopped in Iraq with what is going on presently with the sabotage of the infrastructure?
Well, I think what we need to stop the Bush administration are two things. One, resistance from within, certainly, and that's ongoing, by the Iraqi people against the occupation of their homeland. That is taking place. But we need a consistent, articulate, anti-war network, movement and network, which spreads across the land, across America, across Canada, across the European Union, all around the world, and which goes to the heart of this agenda. It doesn't demand necessarily simply an inquiry or that the Bush administration be impeached. It tackles the broader issue of the legitimacy of the New World Order. It dismantles the military-industrial complex. It dismantles the military intelligence apparatus, which is behind the Bush administration. It understands that when we're dealing with the criminalization of the state, we can't simply say, "Well, demand for some kind of marginal change." We have to tackle the broad institutions of this new world order: the Patriot Act, the economic apparatus which is behind it, the crony financial system, the structures of ownership, the fact that the U.S. Congress is also complicit in the war, the fact that the Democrats are complicit. We can't have simply half measures in this. We need a very, very broad, cohesive, well-organized movement, and we have to go beyond ritualized street events. The street events are important, but they don't change. They create anti-war sentiment, but they don't create a movement. The movement breaks up when the street events are no longer there the following morning, and we have to change the whole basis of organization of the anti-war movement from a perhaps less dramatic, visible, mass rallies to the kind of door-to-door networking that people do in an election campaign, where we go, we talk to people in our neighborhood, we establish an anti-war committee in each locality, each school, in the workplace, and ultimately we start to we share information, we establish a network of alternative media where reports on 9/11, on the war, on the nuclear threat are being spread across the land. That's what we have to do. It's not with all due respect, those big anti-war events leading up to the war in Iraq were totally ineffective because they didn't get to the crux. They felt that by having large numbers of people in the streets that they would reverse the tide and so on, but they didn't question the legitimacy of the political actors. They didn't target the political actors in the way in which they should have targeted them. And in other words, they didn't. If we want to reverse the tide of war, we have to undo those war plans. And to undo the war plans, we have to get to the heart of the new world order, of the architects of the new world order, of the economic groups which are behind it, and so on. And that's a much bigger task than simply holding a rally in the streets of Washington or New York.
And 9/11 was a very big piece of the new world order, don't you think?
Yeah, 9/11 was a big piece because it's part of these war pretext incidents, which incidentally there's a whole history on that, and we've documented that in our magazine, in Global Outlook magazine. But yes, we have to reveal 9/11 we have to reveal the complicity of 9/11 because that's also a way of shaking the legitimacy of the system itself. And of its main actors, because once you reveal that 9/11 was not simply an intelligence failure or a lapse in communication between the FBI and the CIA, and that the enemy is not an internal enemy, is not an external enemy, but is a creature of the CIA, and that key members of the Bush administration have complicit links to dubious links to members of Pakistan's inter-services intelligence, which in turn has links to Al-Qaeda and so on, then the whole thing collapses like a deck of cards. And that's very important that we break through this fiction of the Saudi connection, because of these 28 missing pages, because that really confuses everybody. And it's precisely intended to provide legitimacy to the architects of the war on terrorism, who are in fact complicit in these terrorist acts. And we recently had this attack in Indonesia of the Marriott Hotel, which allegedly was conducted by an Indonesian Islamic group, Jemaah Islamiyah, and the head of this organization, Hambasti, has been arrested or pinpointed as the person responsible. What they don't mention in all these reports is that that Jamia Islamia is really the byproduct of the CIA's support to Al-Qaeda, that the leaders were trained in Afghanistan in CIA training camps, that Indonesian intelligence has links to Jamia Islamia, and we know that Indonesian intelligence also has links to the CIA. So that when you start to look at all these very complex relationships, you realize that, in fact, there's something else behind this. And all these terrorist occurrences, if they're part of an intelligence operation, you can be sure that there are directly or indirectly links to the U.S. Intelligence apparatus. So that has to be revealed. We have to reveal those links if we want to disarm the New World Order. And we can't simply do that by saying, I recall the anti-war movement where they said, well, I'm against the war, but I also think that Saddam Hussein is a dictator, okay? Because that all that does is that it justifies the regime removal, okay? I'm not saying that Saddam Hussein is not a dictator. He is a dictator. But to say that he's a dictator as a criterion for waging war virtually provides legitimacy to the war agenda. A lot of people were saying that. They say, yes, we're against the war, but we still think that Saddam Hussein is a dictator. Okay, and they said the same thing about Milosevic, when NATO invaded Yugoslavia, which was also a criminal act. So we have to be very clear who are the warmongers, who are the criminals, and we have to unseat them. And we also have to ultimately tackle the broader issue of the New World Order, which is it's not simply a question of individuals, whether it's George W. or somebody else. They are themselves proxies of the New World Order. They're there to perform certain functions. So that's my understanding of what we should be doing. And, of course, one of the major objectives is to reveal the truth in printed form, in terms of an alternative media. And we can't do that if the alternative media is financed by the Rockefeller Foundation or the Ford Foundation or by George Soros. It has to be, and I say that because they are alternative media, which are being funded essentially by the financiers of the New World Order. Okay, and so you have to be in a position to reveal the truth, criticize the system in a way which is unambiguous, without having links to links to George Soros or links to the Rockefeller Foundation or to the MacArthur Foundation, which fund many of these alternative media outlets.